1953, Iran had a very deep-rooted and significant pro-democracy experience. It had a popular democratic leader who was in power, who had a lot of popular support. And that coup effectively put an end to what I think was the best prospects for democracy in Iran in its modern history.
That's Nader Hashemi, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Nader Hashemi on Iran, the struggle for democracy. Zhou Enlai of China once said, "One of the delightful things about Americans is that they have absolutely no historical memory." Perhaps the former Chinese premier was being too harsh, but then again, maybe he wasn't. Take the case of Iran. Some people remember the 1979 hostage crisis when Iranians stormed the U.S. Embassy in Tehran and took 53 Americans hostage. But how many recall the coup the U.S. engineered that put the Shah back in power, thus crushing democracy in Iran? The consequences of the coup were enormous, and ultimately led to the establishment of the Islamic Republic of Iran. While Iran remains a repressive theocracy, the struggle for democracy, spurred by women and young people, continues. Our guest today is Nader Hashemi. He's director of the Al-Walid Center for Muslim-Christian Understanding at Georgetown University. He was previously the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver. I talked with him on August 24th. Welcome to the program.
Huge honor. I'm sorry I can't do this in person, but next time, inshallah, as they say.
Well, 70 years ago, August 1953, in Operation Ajax, the U.S. and U.K. overthrew the liberal democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran. The coup restored the Shah to power, where he would rule until the 1979 revolution, which led to the creation of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In a recent comment, the well-known Iranian dissident Zahra Rahnavard compares the Islamic Republic of Iran to the regime of the Shah. What is she getting at there?
Well, I think the main argument in Ms. Rahnavard's observation is that the modern history of Iran has been characterized by a steadfast and consistent denial of the people of Iran to their right to self-determination that existed prior to the 79 revolution when the U.S.-backed Shah of Iran was in power. And then after the revolution, when the hardline Islamists eventually consolidated power, they did have popular support, but increasingly over the last 44 years, they have become just another Middle Eastern authoritarian regime, denying the people of Iran their right to self-determination. So I think that's the comparison and the parallel that's being made by this very heroic opposition leader.
The death in Iranian state custody on September 16, 2022, of the 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman Jina Mahsa Amini, it ignited a wave of protests across Iran. Her crime? A dress code hijab violation. What's your analysis of where that movement is a year later?
Well, the movement, the uprising, which really rocked the Islamic Republic to its core, has largely been suppressed by the forces of the state, but it still exists 1 millimeter beneath the surface in terms of the demand for full female autonomy, women's rights, and a broader critique and desire for structural transformation in Iran in the direction of human rights and democracy. So as we're approaching the first anniversary of Mahsa Amini's death, we're seeing in Iran, really over the last several months since the start of the summer, a renewed crackdown on women's rights activists, intellectuals, minority groups, fearing that this first anniversary is going to reignite those protests for women's rights, for human rights and democracy. So the movement has been crushed, but not the aspirations. I think looking back when the history of this phase of Iran is written, the death of Mahsa Amini and the protests that emerged will be a key reference point. I think it marks a shift, a psychological shift in the attitudes of many Iranians toward the regime that rules over them. So that's where things stand.
Some analysts said the protests that followed her death were somehow, the word that was used was different from previous uprisings. And talk about that and the prominence of women in the protests, as well as ethnic minorities. Iran has large populations of Kurds, Arabs, Baluchis, Azeris, and others.
So this is the first time in post-revolutionary Iranian history where women and their rights to equality, their human rights, their rights to full bodily autonomy has been the spark that ignited the protests and encouraged other people to come into the streets. So in that sense, these protests are very different. They were sparked by the death of an innocent woman, and they quickly morphed into demands for structural political change, democratization and human rights among large segments of Iranian society, including, as your question points to, the participation of minority groups, specifically the minority Baluch population that exists in southeastern Iran near the Pakistani border, and the Kurdish population, which exists on the opposite side of Iran and roughly the northwestern part. We have seen large scale and widespread and some of the most deepest and sustained protests in these parts of Iran for reasons that are easily understandable. One, minority groups, particularly ethnic minority groups, suffer from greater discrimination in the Islamic Republic of Iran. They suffer from higher levels of unemployment and poverty, so they have more reasons to protest. But also, in the case of the Iranian Kurds, Mahsa Amini was an Iranian Kurd. Her death really touched a core in the city where she was from and where she was buried. In fact, the slogan that has come to characterize this phase of Iranian protest, you know, women, life, freedom, Zan Zindagi Azadi, was a protest that began at her funeral roughly a year ago and then spread and really became, you know, the anthem for defining this phase of, you know, Iranian protest struggle against the Islamic Republic. And also it should be pointed out, David, that some of the highest number of casualties over the last year were actually sustained in the Baluch province. There was one actually particular day, again, almost a year ago, where close to 100 Iranian protesters in the capital city of Baluchistan, Zahedan, were shot after Friday prayers, many of them in the back after they were protesting. And one of the key characteristics of this protest is the presence of a very senior Sunni cleric. He's the official Friday prayer leader in Zahedan, who's been really leading the charge and mobilizing Iranians of an ethnic Baluch background, protest for their rights and their dignity. And what's so interesting is that the Islamic Republic has not been able to remove him, knowing that had he been toppled or removed or arrested, it would have sparked greater protests in Baluchistan province. So I think those are very important, you know, aspects that I think mark and distinguish this phase of post-revolutionary Iranian protests from previous ones.
And how do religious minorities, Jews, Zoroastrians, Armenian Christians, and others, how do they fare in the Islamic Republic?
Well, not very good. I think the worst case of persecution is the Iranian Baha'i community. They've been targeted for really brutal, systematic attempts to really annihilate them. The other minority groups that we discussed and that you just mentioned, they don't fare very well. There's discrimination, there is greater economic suffering, but it's not the same type of persecution and whole-scale repression that the Iranian Baha'i community has suffered from. So it varies from, you know, community to community. I think Armenian Christians actually are relatively well off compared to the other groups. Interestingly, the Iranian Jewish community doesn't fare very well. It's living under an authoritarian state, and frequently its leaders are targeted for being alleged spies for the state of Israel. But still, notwithstanding the 44 years of existence of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iran still does have the distinction of being and having the second largest Jewish community in the Middle East. It's significantly diminished, but those people who visited and studied and met with the status of the Iranian Jewish community, many of those Iranian Jews feel very Iranian. They don't want to leave. They don't want to go to Israel. They don't want to go to the United States. They want to try and exist in very difficult circumstances in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And so their situation is very precarious. But, you know, the situation of all Iranians, regardless of whether they're part of the majority group or minority group, is very precarious. And that's just one of the features and hallmarks of authoritarian political systems.
In your article, Women, Life, Freedom, you write, I'm quoting, "The mobilization of Iranian women for equal rights can be attributable to several factors. What are they?"
Well, I think the factors that really shape this particular movement was really the lead up to the protest that began roughly a year ago. I think you're quoting from the piece that I wrote, you know, early on in the early days of the protests. And there was a series of events that really led to this uprising. And if you follow the events closely, as I was doing at the time, as Iranian hardliners started to sort of claw back and take over institutions that were previously under the control of reformist politicians or political parties, one of the hallmarks of the Islamic Republic, and particularly the hardline worldview, is this attempt to regulate the behavior of women in public spaces. And so you started to see a steady but consistent crackdown on women's public presence in Iran. So, for example, before women and men in the Isfahan Philharmonic Orchestra were allowed to perform in public places without any concern or harassment, that all of a sudden ended, where women were not allowed to perform with men in an orchestra. You started to see women who were singing in public arrested. You started to see women who were on a public bus and would get into an argument with some other more conservative, religious-leaning women over the role of public dress would be arrested and paraded on television and forced to confess for alleged sins in trying to sort of demand greater rights for women. So there was a series of events that really, I think, were leading up to a major catalyst and explosion of protests that happened right before Mahsa Amini's death. In many ways, you know, Mahsa's death in police custody was the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back and led to this massive, you know, protest movement that lasted for several months and really rocked the Islamic Republic to its core.
You write, "The crisis in Iran today is fundamentally about authoritarianism, not Islam per se." Now, that would go counter to most people's belief that the Islamic Republic of Iran is exclusively about Islam.
Well, the defining ideology of the Islamic Republic is Islam, but it's important to point out it's just one particular interpretation of Islam. There are many Iranian Muslims who disagree with this particular interpretation of Islam. They're silenced. They've been forced to leave. So if you actually look at what's happening in Iran, and there's actually a deeper history here that is often ignored in the reporting in Iran over the question of women's rights and the desire for bodily autonomy. From the inception of the modern state of Iran in the 1920s and 1930s, authoritarian political systems, whether it was under the Pahlavi monarchy or under the Islamic Republic, have tried to control and regulate the behavior of women in public spaces in conformity with a particular ideological project. So just to cite one example, in the 1930s, the father of the Shah that was deposed in 1979, a man by the name of Reza Shah, woke up one day and literally decided he wanted to do something for Iranian women. And so he ordered his troops onto the streets of Tehran to remove the veil or the chador or any head covering from the head of any Iranian woman at bayonet point. And this was a huge shock to a conservative religious society at the time. Many women at the time did not go out in public because they felt that the state would try to, in their eyes, forcibly disrobe them. And it was a huge shock to a conservative society. The successor's son, you know, wasn't as draconian in terms of trying to regulate women's dress code, but did basically have a model for an ideal citizen that was very much in keeping with this secular modernist westernization sort of view of how a proper Iranian woman citizen should behave. There was never any freedom of choice or freedom of, you know, of expression for Iranian women. It was very much the state had a model that they wanted to emulate. And if you didn't follow that model, well, then there were consequences. And so the Islamic Republic comes in 1979 and with their own authoritarian mindset decides to create their own model citizenship. And when it came to women, that meant wearing a particular dress code. And if you didn't accept those new rules, you would find yourself in trouble by the state, arrested, harassed, forced to go to educational sort of schools to learn the proper way to behave. And so this is very much part of a longer story. And I think it very much is about, you know, authoritarian political systems and mindsets. I mean, one of the good things that I've actually noticed in the last year of protests is you have a lot of Iranian religious women who voluntarily choose to wear the hijab, supporting their more secular sisters in the streets, demanding the right to, you know, full female bodily autonomy. So in that sense, I say this moment in Iranian history and politics is very much about the politics of authoritarianism. It's not about Islam.
There was a significant uprising in 2009, particularly around the whole issue of voting, and there were large crowds. In fact, those crowds seemed in numbers larger than what turned out in 2022-2023. Is that accurate?
That is accurate. So in the aftermath of what was widely perceived as a stolen election in June of 2009, there was a major protest that happened a few days later. In fact, the date was June the 15th, 2009. I was following events very closely. And the Islamic Republic itself admitted there were 3 million people on the streets of Tehran alone protesting a stolen election. So in that sense, those elections, I think, did produce larger numbers of people on the streets in the major cities. I think the difference this time around is the numbers haven't been as bigger, but the participation of people in smaller towns and villages and of a younger age cohort is really what distinguishes this phase of Iranian protests. So they're wider in the sense that these protests, in contrast to 2009, are taking place in more cities and towns. And the demographic and economic, I think, background of the people protesting this time around in 2022 comprises, I think, more people from poorer socioeconomic backgrounds were really frustrated over the state of politics and the state of the country. Back then, it was largely a middle-class urban movement that was protesting rights and freedoms and a stolen election. The other, I think, key aspect, and we know this from official figures that the Islamic Republic has published, most of the people on the street over the last year that were arrested and that the Islamic Republic has admitted to was a very young age cohort. Roughly 15 to 25. Iranians over the age of 25 over the last year did not come out onto the street in big numbers. And that raises some important questions. And my explanation for that is that the brutal sanctions that have been imposed on Iran, comprised with and complemented by the massive economic mismanagement by the regime, has produced an economic devastating scenario where if you're over 25 and you have a family, to not go to work at a protest effectively means that the next day your family doesn't eat or can't survive. It becomes very costly and very difficult to, I think, sustain popular mobilization under dire economic conditions. And so that, I think, explains the demographic numbers in terms of why this was largely a younger cohort of young kids that were protesting, demanding rights and freedoms as opposed to a more older constituency.
Talk about the whole issue of sanctions and their efficacy. Cuba, 60 plus years. Iran, 40 plus years. You'll also recall the sanctions on Iraq in the 1990s and up to the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. Who gets hurt?
Well, it's the average citizen who gets hurt, and that's the tragedy. Average citizens who have no say over the policies of the government that rules over them. They pay the price. And of course, this has, I think, a very catastrophic effect on the ability of citizens to mobilize and organize and fight back against authoritarianism. So in that sense, I think the sanctions that have been imposed on Iran, really by Donald Trump when he, you know, tore up the nuclear agreement and imposed what his advisors called crippling sanctions, has actually hurt the average Iranian citizen has actually hurt the particular constituency of middle-class young people and their parents who, you know, you would hope would participate in popular mobilization against the regime. And that raises the question, so why are these sanctions there in the first place? And my own reading, specifically with respect to Iran, and I think this also applies to Cuba sanctions, is that these are sanctions that are usually imposed by the United States, largely for domestic American political reasons. In other words, politicians, mostly from the Republican Party, but also from the Democratic Party, find it politically advantageous to claim that we have applied another layer of sanctions on Iran. Look how tough we are. Look how, you know, strong we are in fighting back against the authoritarian policies of the Islamic Republic. On the other side of the equation, within Iran, they actually undermine the struggle for democracy, they target innocent people, and they actually, in the case of Iran, and I'm prepared to advance this argument, actually strengthen the regime, all things considered, particularly the hardliners who have, you know, their own ways of avoiding sanctions and maintaining their income and their status of living. So all things considered, I think these sanctions are catastrophic. They hurt innocent people, and they fundamentally undermine the struggle for democracy in Iran.
You mentioned the U.S.-Iran agreement that Obama negotiated in 2015, which Trump nixed in 2018. Is it because of those political domestic reasons you just referred to that Biden has not revived the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action?
Well, Biden came into office as a candidate claiming that he wanted to revive the Iran nuclear agreement. But what we saw is that when he came into power, he was very slow in dragging his feet to resume negotiations. That pushed the clock back, and then it overlapped with the departure of the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, who was very much in favor of the nuclear agreement. In fact, he negotiated it with the Obama administration. There was a series of negotiations that took place in Vienna, and by the time they were reaching fruition, the Rouhani administration's time had run out. A hardline Iranian president came in who was dedicated to opposing the JCPOA. And so in many ways, one can make the argument that one reason why the agreement wasn't revived was really the slow motion approach to these talks by the Biden administration. And following why the Biden administration was so slow, I think they were, you know, trying to pursue negotiations to make sure they were politically compatible with the temperature here in Washington, D.C. They didn't want to present themselves as being soft on Iran, and that's pushed the clock back. And so there was a window of opportunity, I think, that we had under the former Iranian President Rouhani that perhaps could have revived the JCPOA. But that window now has effectively closed. It's an open question whether those talks can be revived. And of course, one of the big concerns is that without a nuclear agreement, the chance of a military strike or a military campaign against Iran's nuclear program remains very high, either by the Israelis or possibly by a future Trump administration. People forget this, that when Trump was actually in power, on at least three occasions, we came very close to a military confrontation with Iran under the leadership of Donald Trump. And so the big fear is that if the Republicans come back into the White House in 2024, we could be on the precipice of another war in the Middle East, just like we were when Trump was in power.
The president that succeeded Rouhani is Ibrahim Raisi. You talk about him in terms of the Talibanization of Iran. What are his politics? Is he a cleric, by the way?
He's a cleric. He comes from he's married into a very well-known hardline family of clerics. He's basically viewed as a mouthpiece for the Iranian supreme leader. He lacks charisma, very much, you know, reads from the playbook of Iranian hardliners. And he came into office claiming that, look, one of the problems that we have in Iran today is that we've forgotten these revolutionary, allegedly Islamic ideals. And we have to go back to those ideals that were, you know, foundational to the Islamic Republic. And of course, one of those ideals, and this is one of the pillars of the Islamic Republic, is the attempt to control women's lives in public spaces. And there was too many women not observing the hijab, exercising a lot of liberties. And when he came to power, he promised to change that. And that's something that I should have mentioned in response to an earlier question, David. One of the successes of this women's rights protest in Iran is that if you go to many major urban cities in Iran today, you see a lot of women just walk around without the hijab. They've effectively reclaimed public spaces, and the regime doesn't have the willingness or the security personnel to chase every woman around the city and impose the hijab forcibly on their heads. And that, in many ways, is an important victory, that you see that larger numbers of Iranian women have voluntarily just defied the national hijab laws, thus reclaiming these public spaces. And it's an open question whether the Islamic Republic, if it wants to, can reimpose those policies back on the heads of Iranian women. They're trying to do new tactics, if you're following the debate, using surveillance technology, facial recognition technology to find women if they're caught photographed without the hijab, making it more costly for them to, you know, exist in Iran, or to charge businesses. If a non-hijab wearing woman goes into a business, they'll fine the business, those types of tactics. It remains to be seen whether that'll be victorious, but these are very much the policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and Iranian women are very much at the forefront of the struggle for rights and freedoms.
What sectors of Iranian society support the government? And comment on the influence of the Revolutionary Guards, a kind of state within a state with its military and economic power.
It's tough to measure how much support the Islamic Republic actually has. I would give, if I had to put a percentage on it, I would say roughly perhaps 10 to 15%. And that's comprised of, I think, people who are religiously conservative and buy into the narrative of the state, that this is an Islamic society, and if you're a good Muslim, you have to listen to the supreme leader. I think that's mostly an older generation. I think even from within this conservative religious constituency in Iran, the younger generation is very skeptical, and I think much more independent-minded. And then, like any authoritarian political system that has a lot of money, in this case from the sale of oil, you have people who support the system, not because they ideologically buy into the narrative of the authoritarian regime, but because their livelihood, their income is dependent on supporting the political status quo. And so the Islamic Republic employs millions of people, either directly or indirectly, and this is a source of support for the regime. And these people know that if the regime were to topple, they would lose their livelihood and the advantages that they have. The IRGC, the Islamic Republic Revolutionary Guard Corps, is the most powerful and significant military institution in the state. The origins of their existence go back to the dawn of the Islamic Republic, where the revolutionary leaders of Iran believed that the existing Iranian military, trained by the Americans, would not be loyal enough. So we needed another military force in the case of a crisis that would support the revolution and be there to protect the revolution. And that's where the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps was formed. That's why they were formed. Roughly 2 decades after the Islamic Republic was formed, you started to see large parts of the Iranian economy being taken over by the military in ways that are very similar to the Pakistani military, the Egyptian military, and other military regimes. In other words, this gives the Revolutionary Guard Corps an investment, an economic incentive to fight for the status quo, because now they have accrued huge profits by virtue of their control over the economy. And they are known now to control, you know, depending on the estimates, 30 to 40% of the Iranian economy. They're thus a major player. And it's generally known, if there ever is going to be a democratic transition in Iran, the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, their institution will be taken down because they're so deeply connected with the ruling regime. And thus they have a lot to fight for.
You're listening to Nader Hashemi on Iran, the struggle for democracy. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Well, the U.S. and Iran, despite all the adversity, are actually talking. Witness the mid-August deal where five U.S. citizens will be exchanged. It hasn't happened yet, but that's the idea. Five U.S. citizens will be exchanged, and for Iran to access 6